All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 14th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. It is 39 degrees, cloudy and damp here in upstate New York. It's supposed to get up near 50 for the next, 5 days or so. So this should be almost a little taste of spring. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Universal Vaccine, DARPA, Sky Virus, Mutant Crayfish, DNA, and Blockchain. And there were some pretty strange stories over the last week or so. Of course, we have viruses falling from the sky, and they kind of get up into the troposphere. And travel around, so be careful. Cloudy with a Chance of Virus was the one title. But we ended up looking at some of these technologies now. We looked at blockchain a couple different times. This big database in the sky that's going to be immutable, quote unquote. And be able to do things like, upload mind files or store your DNA. To be able to then be utilized as some sort of cryptocurrency to then sell and make micropayments to you for your information as part of the Internet of Things. Now, guys, there's some pretty freaky things going on right now. And I know we talk about a lot of different technologies, but we're at this level where they're able to manipulate biology and all the laws of physics, nature, light, sound. We found that all these different inputs are ways of manipulating cells. Optogenetics, and I just saw, if anyone catches my Twitter feed, there were a couple news stories the other day about Optogenetics 2.0, and they'll be utilizing sound, and I don't know if they were using LED light or how they were getting the light in. Oh, nanoparticles. Nanoparticles and maybe RF. We read about that as well. And reprogramming cells, turning them into stem cells or into any other type of cell that they wanted, just using the iPS skin scrapings. So there was a series, and I know I always hate when people tie things back to TV, but I got to tell you, sometimes I find it as a way to numb. It's almost like a drug. It really is. But I find it as a way to numb. Especially when I've had some stress, a lot of stress, and I've been pushing myself as hard as I can. It's a good way to numb and just totally drop out without ever having to go somewhere. And there was some new series that Clint Richardson actually mentioned to me called Altered Carbon. It's on Netflix. It just started recently. So I just blew through all those episodes. It was all about immortality. And in the future, how they had this ability to not only mind upload, but physically, digitally upload every detail about you into this little disk thing that then was placed at the base of the skull, I guess, by the spine. I don't know exactly how they did that physically, but it just popped in there, and that was like your identity disk. And they could 3D print bodies and then upload their, and they would back themselves up to a cloud-based server. But only the richest people actually could attain immortality and an endless number of printed clones that they could then upload themselves into. It was pretty messed up. I actually didn't enjoy it until later in the series, but I watched it, and it brought up some potentially scary side effects to that, because I see the science for all of this is budding right now. So somebody was pretty crafty in coming up with the storyline. So listen to this. So we discussed Georgie Porgy Church popped up his ugly head the other day. We found out that he is looking at helping people put their DNA on the blockchain. I want to talk about some combinations of biology and technology today, and we're going to get to some scary places. So one of the big things that's coming, of course, is the Internet of Things. which I like to affectionately call the Internet of Everything, something that was coined by Cisco very, very early back in the early 2000s. At the time when they were selling that tagline to us, I laughed at them. But I'm not laughing anymore. All right, so the Internet of Things. Our shoes and our watches like to surf the web too. The smart devices we use every day are becoming more widespread, so look out. You are connected, you're hooked in, you're linked up, much more than you realize, and it's all because of the Internet of Things. But what is it? Sometimes it's as easy as a warehouse tracking the location of a package. Other times it's as high tech and it is high dollar. McAfee explains that IoT refers to the connection between an object and the internet with the purpose of making products, quote unquote, smarter and allowing users to operate devices from afar, whether that is from a computer or another smart device. Now, anyone who's gotten into smart home technology, and I remember back in the day, I don't remember the name of the manufacturer, but you used to be able to get these little plug-in devices that you could plug then your appliances into and then go into a little interface that allowed you to program times of day or different interactions that would turn your lights or your water on in your house, or you could have moisture sensors near your water meter and your hot water tank and that type of thing. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, that was probably 10 or 15 years back. But one of the things that we are looking at now is that this Internet of Things is rolling out into our devices that we use every day, like our televisions. We forget about the TVs because they're pretty ubiquitous. Or any type of communication device where you can receive and send information. I'm telling you, every bit of that is bag tagged and tracked, not even necessarily to an IP, but to something that is called an ASIC. And it's this ASIC, which is something that's hard-coded onto a board, soldered on typically, in code, EEPROM, burned in type stuff. An ASIC is the chip that identifies a piece of hardware. It's got codes or serial numbers burned into them that are permanent and individualistic, so they can track it back to a manufacturer and to a point of sale where it was sold. And maybe if you used a credit card, they might even be able to find you. It is not unprecedented. So when you start looking, you know, then you add things such as Siri and Alexa. I'd like to see the numbers for purchases or for usage on those devices now in 2018. I just can't even believe that we've made it to 2018. But when you start looking at the pervasiveness and the fact that you are using your voice, which we've talked about that before, they are able now to use artificial intelligence to be able to detect not only physical but mental disease just by the sound of your voice. I also saw one here recently that there's a new artificial intelligence app that is free, by the way. So run out and download it. It'll be able to pinpoint how soon it is before you die, which is pretty horrible. Oh, yeah, here it is. As a wake-up call for better health, this AI will tell you how long you will live, and it's free. So step right up. It's pretty messed up. So, all right, where are we going to go from here? So let's go back here to this, what is the Internet of Things? For instance, a Fitbit tracking steps, shoots them up to the cloud. That's IoT. Same for Amazon's new in-house assistant, Alexa, and even heart monitors that can be read online. That's where they're really pushing this is healthcare, home, and being able to track, bag, and tag you at all times. Worldwide, there are already nearly 27 billion connected IoT devices in 2017, according to a recent industry analysis, and there are a lot more on the way. The firm IHS Market writes, one projection is a 12% annual jump leading up to 2030 to 125 billion, with a B, devices. Projections vary, but they all start with B for big and billion. And another term that I've been seeing quite a bit is MIOT, which is Massive Internet of Things. And that is all part of the 5G rollout, phase two or so. Smart home devices alone, like doorbells and thermostats, which now, since Google has fully acquired Nest, Google is going to be involved in monitoring your doorbells with video camera and thermostats. And we found out a while ago that they were using facial recognition software on those doorbells as well, and are expected to pass 800 million in the U.S. by 2022. The technology is fairly straightforward, but Business Insider says that some things rely on Wi-Fi. Others use simple radio frequency chips to send out info that is received by a secure platform. IoT is clearly infiltrating, ding, ding, every crevice of life. This is what I am telling you not to allow it to do. You know, we are enslaved by our smartphones, and some of us even our computers. That's where we do our daily work. But at least we can close the door and walk away. Do not allow it to infiltrate, as they call it, every crevice of your life. And now the question is, will it keep us safe? Which is, of course, how they sell it to you. Or could security systems be compromised in everything from pacemakers to baby monitors to cars speeding up and down the roads as your self-driving cars are talking to the smart cloud? So, all right, now let's get back to the story. I mentioned this AI can predict how long that you are going to live. And don't worry about it, because it is all free. Yeah, this is great. Get into the scanner, Jenny. He is busy being born. Wait, he not busy being born is busy dying, says Bob Dylan. And of course, he is right. We are all ticking time bombs in our own way. Wow, isn't that a way to sell it? We think that by and large, we pass on in order of age, but that is just one metric. It is a pretty coarse-grained one, and there are a lot of other predictors of longevity. Each has its own health and quote-unquote age, and that's its own clock, if you will. Young.ai is a new project currently in beta testing that uses AI to track your quote-unquote age of your systems in order to derive a more meaningful prediction of our biological age and thus our lifespan. To seek to identify the weakest clocks as the ones most likely to become life-threatening. Young AI is a project of In Silico Medicine, whose mission it is to use artificial intelligence for drug discovery, biomarker development, and aging research. It follows a deep learning analysis by In Silico of blood tests from 130,000 South Koreans, Canadians, and Eastern Europeans, and scientists from Johns Hopkins, University of Oxford, and other research institutions all participated in the study. It was apparently the largest ever such analysis performed in the longevity field, and it has produced a model using, quote-unquote, several deep learning-based projections of biological age trained upon population-specific blood biochemistry and hematological cell count data sets. Ding! And it was published in the Journal of Gerontology. Polina Memoshina, a senior research scientist in In Silico Medicine, says that today, thanks to AI and the incredibly fast computational power of our deep learning neural networks, we can discover patterns and formulas in huge pools of blood work that could not be discovered just a few years ago. Remember, it's all about big data. The project looked at 21 commonly measured blood parameters such as cholesterol, inflammation markers, hemoglobin count, and albumin levels, along with 17 other chemical indicators. Though AI analysis aligning blood chemistry with age, ethnicity, and other data, In Silico believes it has produced an algorithm that offers the, quote, first truly reliable aging clock for humans. And it says that now, simply through the analysis of a single drop of blood, they can determine an individual's life expectancy. Now, how insane is that? One of the things I was thinking, too, if there are 21 commonly measured blood parameters that can be indicators of your longevity, you know, how else could this information be used? If they know what things can make you age quickly, maybe they could somehow target those chinks in the armor. Remember, it's all a double-edged sword. The more information we feed into the machine, the bigger the data sets are, the more easily we can be targeted. in the future by our biological weaknesses. Anyone can find out what their medical future looks like, according to In Silico's algorithm, by going to the young.ai website. The analysis is free, and participants have their blood locally tested for 18 parameters and then upload the results to the Young AI site, along with a facial photo. Oh, yeah, right. For another In Silico AI algorithm that can assess aging based on visual indicators. Yeah, no thanks. It only takes a couple seconds for the site to return a report, and if it shows a biological clock age that is older than one's chronological age, In Silico hopes that the analysis can help subjects take the necessary steps to shore up their weakest indicators before it is too late. In Silico CEO Alex Zhekranov says that our tests give people a sober look at how fast or how slow their biological clock is ticking. I don't know. I think this might be kind of a neat idea, but I would not upload my blood with my picture and my whatever social security number or digital tracking ID for the future blockchain for them to do whatever they want. So now let's go another step. So we've talked about the Internet of Things. We talked about them being able to bag and tag us at a very intricate biological level. So I ran across this story this morning. Closer to the edge, as you're talking about mobile technology at blazing speed, one of the things that ends up being a limiter of some of these new high-speed wireless technologies is the capability to be able to crunch large amounts of data at what they call the edge, and that is at the end-user location. So you can keep the user experience and low latency up. Well, one of the things that they have looked at doing is moving some of the intelligence back into the Internet of Things devices. And this caught my attention. Brain-inspired technologies, so nothing new there, will bring data processing and analytics to Internet of Things devices. CEA, Litai's chief scientist, issued a forward-looking call to action for the microelectronics industry to create radically new digital communication architectures for the Internet of Things, which will be a great deal of analytical processing occurring at the edge and the end devices instead of in the cloud. So this would be looking at more of a distributed architecture, was what struck my attention. Kind of like, again, blockchain. We're seeing these patterns playing over and over again. See, you can do the work. Your end, your internet connection can be the connection of the global network and do the work on your end and pump out stats and maybe even sell them, make some income in the world of no jobs. Delivering a keynote presentation at the kickoff of the ISSCC 2018, Barbara DeSalvo said this architecture will include human brain-inspired hardware coupled to new computing paradigms and algorithms that will allow for distributed intelligence over the whole Internet of Things network, all the way down to ultra-low power end devices. We are entering a new era where artificial intelligence systems are shaping the future world, says DeSalvo, who also is Leti's scientific director. And with the end of Moore's Law in sight, transformative approaches are needed to address the enduring power efficiency issues of traditional computing architectures. The potential efficiencies of processing data at the edge of networks, e.g. by small computers located near the Internet of Things connected devices or inside and very tiny, rather than at a distance, centers around the cloud are increasingly cited as long-term goals of the Internet of Things. But the challenges to realize this mission are formidable. For example, IoT battery-powered devices lack both processing power to analyze the data they receive and the power source that would support data processing. to break through these barriers, DeSalvo called for a quote-unquote holistic research approach to the development of low-powered architectures inspired by the human brain, where the process development and integration, circuit design and system architecture, and learning algorithms are simultaneously optimized. Now, do you remember we read about a synthetic neuron back a few weeks ago that actually processed information like 100 billion times faster than biological neurons. So don't think they're not already working on this stuff. She envisions a future in which optimized neuromorphic hardware will be implemented as a highly promising solution for future ultra-low-powered cognitive systems that will extend well beyond the Internet of Things. Emerging technologies such as advanced CMOS 3D technologies, emerging resistive memories, and silicon photonics, coupled with novel brain-inspired paradigms such as spike coding and spike time-dependent plasticity, have extraordinary potential to provide intelligent features and hardware approaching the way knowledge is created and processed in the human brain. DeSalvo's presentation, called Brain-Inspired Technologies, Toward Chips That Think, included summaries of key research findings in a variety of fields that will play a role in developing brain-inspired technologies for computing and data handling requirements in a hyper-connected world. And we found out on Friday, last live show, that there was a neuroscientist, I think he was in Africa somewhere, who had created a silicon chip that he had fused live neurons into to sniff out bombs. And like I said, when I first originally read this, I thought it was a joke story, but it's not. I found this in quite a few scientific publications now. But he created a device utilizing living neurons from mice to sniff out bomb threats in airports. You think the processing power that is going to run the robots of the future will be synthetic biology based? Ding, ding. And we are laying the foundations for that today. He says this Kanaku core is a rather amazing device in its own right, but the amalgam of living neurons and computer chips, oh, you mean just like living brains, little tiny brain-inspired edge technologies that can live in the Internet of Things type stuff, yeah, just like that. But the amalgam of living neurons and computer chips that underpins the project could have a profound impact as this technology matures. And remember, too, we also were reading about some of this new DNA technology. DARPA has jumped all over this. The Georgie Porgie Church is in the middle as well. Back in 2012, he had actually encoded a book on DNA. There's a story out of MIT Technology Review on that. And then we found out back in 2015 that they had built a DNA hard drive that can store data for for a million years, not enough zeros, and one single strand of DNA preserved in glass. Then the other day we read February 8th, 2018, human sequencing pioneer Georgie Church wants to give you the power to sell your DNA on the blockchain. And then there was something we had run across a while before, and I mentioned this many times. I went back and dug up the article. This is out of the broadinstitute.org, the good old Broad Institute, biologically inspired engineering. DARPA awarded them in 2015 a $32 million contract to MIT and the Broad Institute to bolster DNA design and manufacturing. What? Why would we need DNA manufacturing? Well, good question, because DARPA now wants to build an image search engine out of DNA, and we read that the other day as well. It's not going to be Google searching cat videos on YouTube anymore. It's going to be a search engine from tagged photos using DNA sequencing looking for ATCs and Gs that were encoded as different colors and types of images and storage that has been put into DNA. We found out, too, that just in a semi-tractor trailer, 10 tons of DNA, they could store every single piece of content from the entire planet on that. Last but not least, there was a startup that then wanted to connect, and I think this is where we ended up the show Friday, thousands of 3D printers onto a blockchain-based network hub. The reason why this is important is because there were a couple different stories about 3D printed things. One of the things I started squawking about just as the music came in Friday was about them talking about 3D printing vaccines. Of course, remember, in the future, if there is a pandemic, that's how they're going to get it out to all the places where they want to distribute it, is to 3D print it out. We also found out that they have these farms where they're growing cell cultures of things. One of them happens to be neurons. It was quite a while back. We covered that one. So now, if we will be able, and I think the story said they were going to have thousands of these things. It might have started simple, printing small objects, but last couple years, 3D printing technology has really outgrown itself. Now it is both possible to 3D print tiny structures using living cells, ding, ding, like a vaccine, or what? Oh, an organ. Or maybe even beyond an organ as scans get better and more invasive and more detailed. But now, behind the idea of 3D manufacturing, of course, that is not new, but New 3D Token, which is a project of an Italian company, wants to integrate it with blockchain so it can create a one-of-a-kind, global, decentralized, just-in-time factory 4.0 matching the digital revolution of the 21st century. With steady growth, more than 270,000 desktop 3D printers were available worldwide in 2015, and upcoming years will make these printers more and more affordable, pointing toward a possible increase in demand. This is where 3D Tokens Project wants to tap in to create a blockchain-managed network hub of those thousands of 3D printers. Could you imagine? It might be kind of cool because you could put your 3D printer up on the blockchain and put it for hire. Though you could pack and ship it afterward. Dubbed Network Robots Workforce. This network will be able to change the traditional industry norms from time to market to production costs, and their blockchain-based online platform will function as a facilitator between innovative 3D manufacturing projects, and it could greatly reduce production costs. At the moment, the company mounts a network of 100 3D printers, and through the 3D token project, they aim to increase the number to 3,000 by the end of 2019, with 1,000 network members and production capacities up to 300 tons of processed bioplastics. Yeah, that's going to be good for the environment. So as of now, that Italian company has managed to stick a deal through its current network with such industry giants as the design shop chain Flying Tiger Copenhagen, which has 600 shops globally, and through this collaboration, they'll roll out an innovative desktop 3D printing learning device and a lamp called Q3D during the upcoming months. The 3D tokens, hence the name, will also introduce its own native cryptocurrency, of course, called 3DT, based on Ethereum blockchain. And their ICO ends on February 11th, so that was 3 days ago. Users will be able to join crowdfunding campaigns, spend their coins at their internal marketplace, like purchasing digital models for their own projects, or even trade 3DTs within the network at a fixed price revealed at the end of the initial coin offering. Those holding into their 3DTs will also be able to receive profits from the network directly. And however, people from the U.S. and China won't be able to purchase any coins, due to various regulations. And even citizens or residents from Singapore, Hong Kong, and Canada should check if they are eligible before buying non-refundable tokens. There is a growing interest in incorporating blockchain technology into 3D manufacturing, and it is gradually being accepted. Even the U.S. Navy has considered making use of the secure data transfer blockchain could provide their 3D printing processes, and various stages of the 3D printing process can itself benefit from the decentralized peculiarities of blockchain, distributing such tasks as slicing stage among different users and ease on their computer's capability. If realized, 3D token networks could accelerate 3D printing markets to its full potential. And they've even talked about putting 3D printers in space and maybe as part of the Mars mission of the future to be able to print tools and things of that nature while off-world, maybe even vaccines or cellular structures like organs. Here's another story, February 1st, 2018, out of phys.org, the 3D printing of living cells. This is one of the things that came up in that Altered Carbon, was being able to print copies of yourself, and they had this neat helical-shaped, with all these lights on it, but who knows? I mean, there's all kinds of weird technologies they could do with flipping genetic switches with light and sound, like I said. So who knows? It was kind of neat, but they would print, 3D print, in this structure, this copy of themselves. So 3D printing living cells, phys.org, February 1st, 2018. Using a new technique they call in-air microfluidics. So what is this, floating in the air? University of Twente scientists succeeded in printing 3D structures with living cells. The special technique enables the fast and on-the-fly production of micro building blocks that are available, that are viable, and can be used for repairing damaged tissue, for example. The work is presented in Science Advances. Microfluidics is all about manipulating tiny drops of fluid with sizes between a micrometer and a millimeter. And most often, chips with tiny fluidic channels, reactors, and other components are used for this, like in DARPA's lab on a chip systems. And although these chips offer a broad range of possibilities in producing emulsions, for example, droplets carrying another substance, the speed of which droplets leave the chip is typically in the microliter per minute range. And for clinical and industrial applications, this is not fast enough. Filling a volume of a cubic centimeter would take about 1,000 minutes or 17 hours. And this technique that is being presented now does it in just a couple of minutes. We can reach these higher speeds by not manipulating the fluids into microchannels, but into air instead. Well, this is one question that researchers wanted to answer, and indeed that it was possible using two jets of fluid. This is like going to be inkjet 3D printing. From one jet, droplets are shot at the other jet. Creating the jets is relatively simple, and they move from 100 to 1,000 times faster than droplets from a microchip. Speed is not the only advantage. By choosing jets containing different types of fluids that react, the collision results in new materials, and smart combinations of fluids will result in solid and printable building blocks in just one step. In this way, it is possible to capture a living cell inside of a printable material, and the resulting bio-building blocks are printed in a 3D structure that looks like a sponge filled with cells and fluid. And these 3D modular biomaterials have an internal structure that is quite similar to that of natural tissue. Uh-oh. Many 3D printing techniques are based on using heat or ultraviolet light that would damage living cells, but the new microfluidic approach is therefore a promising technique in tissue engineering. Uh-oh. And which damaged tissue is repaired by using cultured cell material of the patient. The research has been done by Tom Camperman of the Developmental Bioengineering Group of Professor Marcel Campion and the Klaus William Wieser of Physics of Fluid Groups of Professor Dilef Lose. Camperman just finished his PhD on the subject, and Klaus Willem Wieser temporarily works as a Harvard scientist on the Rubicon grant, which I don't even know what that is, but that sounds pretty ominous. He'll return to the University of Twente afterwards and become an assistant professor, and both scientists are involved in the new EM fluidic spinoff, in which in-air microfluidics is used to create functional particles and materials. The paper, called in-air microfluidics, enables rapid fabrication of emulsion, suspension, and 3D modular biomaterials. And it was published online January 31st, 2018 in Science Advances. So what do you think about them, apples? They could print living biomaterial in mid-air and create structures. So I was reading then about a 3D body scanning technology company called Shapify.me. Yeah, Shapify.me. And they got all kinds of different divisions. One of them happens to be healthcare. So here you can go, maybe at some event, into an Arctic Shapify booth. The Arctic, and that's A-R-T-E-C, the Arctic Shapify booth is a 3D body scanning and selfie making automated machine, and it almost looks like a naked body scanner from the airport, if you had to ask me. But it's not. It uses some sort of quote-unquote safe technology to 3D scan you. But, you know, think about that. They could turn up the frequencies to millimeter or terahertz waves and get down under the skin even. Or maybe even put an MRI or a CT camera in there and get a full body scan like that. And then print you, you know, and then get a mind file by doing the EEGs and maybe even little cortical stimulators or something. I don't know. But I'm just saying, looking at where this technology is just starting right now, I see some of those things in the potential future. So use it to sell hundreds of high-quality personal figurines every month and scan your customers in 12 seconds. 5 minutes later, a detailed 3D model is created automatically. 3D print your model using the Shapify printing and delivery all-inclusive service, or use your own 3D printer. Customers then return to collect their printed Shapey on a designated day or receives it in the mail. And one of the things that was crazy is you go to their medical healthcare 3D modeling section, and this is using a product called either Eva or Space Spider, which I thought was pretty good. They can create an arm. They can create an ear, and this is with very high resolution. They can scan an eye or an entire face for, of course, like dental surgery or something. They can get foot molds or full body scans, hand bones with your nails, full head scans, infant skull scans, backbone and rib scans, top of your hand or your torso. This is just very frightening, and they can use them for all kinds of things. Industrial, healthcare, science, and art and design. You can reverse engineer and do healthcare stuff. I mean, really, where is this going? And as more and more people step up for this technology and get themselves scanned into a digital state to then be stored somewhere in a cloud forever and ever in some sort of DNA 1 million-year storage encased in glass that then turns into some sort of what they called in that show a stack, that then you can be 3D printed, brought back, and bloop, re-uploaded. I mean, it's very potential future once they work all the kinks out of the machine. So then I did a quick search, and yes, lo and behold, Smithsonian.com. Soon, maybe your doctor, maybe you'd need a prescription to create a replication of yourself. If you even go back to like the second reincarnation of Battlestar Galactica, they had the skin jobs who could actually recreate themselves on the fly. The second they died, bloop, they came right back. Soon, your doctor could print a human organ on demand. I prescribe a kidney. At a laboratory in North Carolina, scientists are furiously working to create a future in which replacement organs come from a machine. And believe it or not, this was from 2015. On the second floor of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, not far from the elevator bank, is a collection of faded prints depicting great moments in medical history. In one, an ancient Babylonian pharmacist holds aloft a vial of medicine. Another shows a Greek physician, Hippocrates, tending to a patient in a 5th century BC. And the prints were doled out to doctors a half century ago by the pharmaceutical company Parke Davis, which touted them as historical highlight reels. But it is not hard to read their presence at Wake Forest, home to perhaps the largest concentration of medical futurists on the planet. Oh, really? And the ultimate in-joke is, can you believe how far we've come? When I visited the institute in the old North Carolina tobacco town of Winston-Salem, I passed airy laboratories where white-coated staffers glided back and forth across the tiled floor. And on one table, arranged as if for an art exhibit, lay spidery casts of kidney veins rendered in hues of violet and indigo and cotton candy. This is a very strangely written article. Down the hall, a machine zapped sporadic electrical currents through two sets of muscle tendons, one cut from a rat and the other engineered from biomaterials and cells. A researcher named Young Jun Sul met me at the door to a room marked bioprinting. And Young Jun, tousled hair and wearing plastic framed eyeglasses, grew up in South Korea and trained in mechanical engineering at a university in Pyeongchang. At Wake Forest, he is now part of the group that works with the lab's custom-built bioprinters, which are powerful machines that operate in much the same way as a standard 3D printer. An object is scanned or designed using modeling software, and then the data is sent to a printer, which uses syringes to lay down successive coats of matter until a three-dimensional object emerges. Traditional 3D printers tend to work in plastic or on wax. What's different here, says Jung, nudging his eyeglasses up his nose, is that we have the capability to print something that is alive. Oh, this is just nuts, guys, because they really can do this now. He gestured at the machine to his right, and it bore a passing resemblance to one of those claw games you find at a highway rest stop. And the frame was heavy metal, the walls were transparent, and inside were six syringes arranged in a row. One held a biocompatible plastic that, when printed, would form the interlocking structure of a scaffold, which would be the skeleton, essentially, of a printed human organ or a body part. The other could be filled with a gel containing human cells or proteins that promote their growth. Yeah, that would probably be some sort of stem cell. And as the scaffold is being printed, cells from an intended patient are printed onto and into the scaffold, and the structure is then placed in an incubator where the cells multiply. And in principle, the object is implanted onto or into the patient. And in time, the object becomes as much a part of the patient's body as the organs he was born with. Or that is our hope, anyway, says Young Jun. Young Jun has reprogrammed one of the printers to begin the process of creating a scaffold for a human ear. Oh, just like this high-resolution 3D model we were just reading about before. And the room was filled with a comforting electronic hum, broken only by an occasional gasp from a printer and the release of the compressed air that kept it working. Peering through the glass case, I could see that the scaffolding coming into being by degrees was small and delicate and extremely ear-like. And because the process would take hours to complete, Young Jun handed me a finished version to handle. Oh, even if it's synthetic, it is a human ear. And it was light and it rested in my palm like a butterfly. Oh, that's really gross. I hope no one was eating breakfast. The external structure of the ear is one of the first structures that the Institute of Wake Forest and other research centers have tried to master as a stepping stone toward the more complicated ones. And Wake Forest staffers have implanted bioprinted skin, ears, bone, and muscle on laboratory animals where they grew successfully into the surrounding tissue. The evangelists of bioprinting, who are increasing the number of 3D printers shipped to medical facilities, is expected to double in the next 5 years, so another good investment probably. And the trials are a harbinger, oh, not a good word, of a world that is only now coming into focus, a world where patients order up replacement body parts the same way they used to order a replacement carburetor for their Chevy. Now that is scary. We tend to think Like the Dell model, says Anthony Atla, a pediatric urologist and the Institute's director, referring to the computer company's famous direct relationship model between the consumer and the manufacturer. We are sitting in Atla's office on the fourth floor at the research center, and you'd have companies that exist to process cells, create constructs, tissue, and your surgeon might take a CT scan, ding, ding, and a tissue sample, and then ship it to the company. A week or so later, an organ would arrive in a sterile container via FedEx, ready for implantation, and presto change-o, a new piece of me, or of you, made to order. This is just crazy. Is this where we're headed? Well, what's interesting is there are no real surgical challenges, says Atla. There are only the technological hurdles that you have to overcome to make sure that the engineered tissue functions correctly in the first place. But we are getting close with simple organs like skin, the external ear, and the tube-like trachea. And at the same time, Atla can't help but look what might come next in his most sanguine. He likes to envision a vast bioprinting industry capable of cranking out big and complex organs, which without the body would fail, like the liver, the kidney, and an industry that could make traditional transplants with their long, often fatal wait times and the ever-present risk of organ rejection completely obsolete. That would be a full-on medical revolution, he says, and it would change everything. And if he's right, Wake Forest, with its purring bio printers and its fleshy ears and multicolored veins and arteries, could be where it is all starting. And the idea that a broken piece of ourselves might be replaced with a healthy piece or a piece from somebody else stretches back centuries. Comas and Damien, patron saints of surgeons, were alleged to have attached the leg of a recently deceased Ethiopian Moor onto a white Roman in the 3rd century AD, and the subject depicted by numerous Renaissance artists. And by the 20th century, medicine had at last begun to catch up with imagination. In 1995, the ophthalmologist Edwin Zerm successfully cut the cornea, from an injured 11-year-old boy and emigrated it into the body of a 45-year-old Czech farm laborer whose eyes had been damaged while he was slaking lime. Later in a decade, Sir Harold Gillies, sometimes called the founder of plastic surgery, performed skin grafts on British soldiers during World War I, and in the first successful transplant of a major organ, an organ vital to human function, didn't happen until 1954 when Ronald Herrick, a 23-year-old from Massachusetts, donated one of his healthy kidneys to his twin brother, Richard, who was suffering from chronic nephritis. But because the identical Herrick twins shared the same DNA, the surgeon was convinced he'd found an end run around the problem of organ rejection, and that surgery was done at Brigham and Women's Hospital. In his autobiography, Surgery of the Soul, the surgeon recalled the moment of triumph. There was a collective hush in the operating room as we gently removed the clamps from the vessels affecting the attached new donor kidney. And as the blood flow was restored, Richard's new kidney began to become engorged and turn pink. There were grins all around, and they proved an essential point about our biological myopia, an insight that drives so much of today's cutting-edge bioengineering. There is no substitute for using a patient's own genetic material. And that's why this is going to be so important. That's why that show I watched was so crazy. They were way beyond printing your own organs. But guys, I see that that technology is going to be very possible here in the not-too-distant future. As scanning technology gets more and more advanced, as surgical science improves along with immunosuppressive treatments that allow patients to accept foreign organs, what once seemed all but out of reach from reality, the first successful pancreas transplant was performed in 1966. And do we really want to talk about all that? I want to talk about 3D printing organs. All right, so we got a few minutes left here. Let's jump ahead. Making the Internet of Things possible with a new breed of memristors. And we have read about memristors before. January 10th, 2018, out of ScienceDaily.com. Easily printable organic thin films can retain data for more than 10 years without power and work with low voltages, as well as become the building blocks of future computers that mimic the human brain. No, wait, didn't we read about us needing end devices that were low powered and mimic human brain for artificial intelligence? Well, look, brand new story, January 10th, So just a month old, 2018. The Internet of Things is coming, and that much we know, but still it won't. Not until we have a component and chips that can handle the explosion of data that comes with the Internet of Things. In 2020, there will already be 50 billion industrial Internet sensors in place all around us, and a single autonomous device, which would be a smartwatch or a cleaning robot or a driverless car, that can produce gigabytes of data each day, whereas an Airbus may have over 10,000 sensors in just one wing alone. Now think about this. With the coming of 5G and the ubiquitousness of connectivity, that is going to enable all of this. Two hurdles need to be overcome. First, the current transistors in computer chips must be miniaturized to the size of only a few nanometers, and the problem is they won't work anymore then. So secondly, analyzing and storing unprecedented amounts of data will require equally huge amounts of energy. So along with Sanji Mujumdar and her colleagues, they are designing a technology to tackle both of these issues. Mujumdar and her colleagues have designed and fabricated the basic building blocks of the future components in what are called neuromorphic computers inspired by the human brain. It is a field of research on which the largest companies in the world and also in the EU are investing heavily. Still, no one has yet come up with a nanoscale hardware architecture that could be scaled to industrial manufacturing and use. The technology and design of neuromorphic computing is advancing more rapidly than its rival revolution, which was quantum computing. Oh, so this is beyond quantum. And there is already wide speculation both in academia and company R&D about ways to inscribe heavy computing capabilities into the hardware of smartphones, tablets, and laptops. The key is to achieve the extremely energy and efficiency of a biological brain and mimic the way neural networks process information through electrical impulses. Now, again, I'm going to point us back to that synthetic artificial synapse or neuron that they created that was a billion times faster than the human neuron, because that was step number one to some of this technology. Because it was very low powered as well. I think it was even more low powered than the human brain. So in the recent article in Advanced Functional Materials, Mujumdar and her team showed that they have fabricated a new breed of, quote, ferroelectric tunnel junctions. That is a few nanometer thick ferroelectric, and that would be like some sort of metal ferro, ferroelectric tunnel junction that is a few nanometers thick, sandwiched between two electrodes, and they have the abilities beyond existing technologies and bode well for energy efficient and stable neuromorphic computing. The junctions work with low voltages of less than 5 volts and with a variety of electrode materials, including silicon used in chips and most of our electronics. They also retain data for more than 10 years without power and can be manufactured in normal conditions. Tunnel junctions have up to this point mostly been made of metal oxides and require 700 degrees Celsius temperatures and high vacuum manufacturing, but ferroelectric materials also contain lead. That's where ferro comes from, which makes them and all of our computers a serious environmental hazard. Our junctions are made out of organic hydrocarbon materials. So look at ding, ding, they're organic. And they would reduce the amount of toxic heavy metal waste in electronics. So that's a good selling point for that. They'll be green. We also can make thousands of junctions in a day at room temperature without them suffering from water or oxygen in the air. And what makes ferroelectric thin film organic components great for neuromorphic computers is their ability to switch between not only binary states of zeros and ones, but a large number of intermediate states as well. So not just quantum with one dual state, but even beyond that, and to store it for a very long time with minute amounts of energy and retain the information they have once received, even after being switched off and on again. So you're not going to get rid of it. We are no longer talking of transistors, but of memristors, and they are ideal for computer simulation to that equal to a biological brain. And for example, the Mars 2020 rover, so interesting to mention Mars, is about to go chart the composition of another planet, but for the rover to work and to process the data on its own, only a single solar panel is an energy source, and the unsupervised algorithms in it will need to use the artificial brain in the hardware. What we are striving for now is to integrate millions of our tunnel junction memristors into a network on one square centimeter of area. Now, can you even understand, like, the insanity of that? So they're going to put millions of tunnel junction memristors, little neuromorphic computers or whatever, data processing units, into a square centimeter of space. And we can expect to pack so many of these in such a small space because we have now achieved a record high difference in the current between on and off states in the junctions, and that proves functional stability. The memristors could then perform complex tasks like image and pattern recognition and make decisions autonomously. Holy shit. This is nuts. So we are going to have artificial intelligence with million little computational chips beyond the quantum level in a cubic centimeter made out of organic material. So here's one more for the very last minute of the show. Organic computers made of DNA could process data inside of our bodies. Oh, yes. Maybe even 3D printed. We invariably imagine electronic devices to be made from silicon chips with which computers store and process information as binary digits. But it need not be this way. Among the alternatives to silicon or our organic mediums such as DNA, DNA computing was first demonstrated in 1994 by Leonard Elderman, who encoded and solved the traveling salesman problem, a math problem that finds the most efficient route for a salesman between two cities, entirely in DNA. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, can store a vast amount of data and amounts of information encoded as sequences, as A, T, C's, and G's. DNA can also be used to control motion, allowing for DNA-based nanomechanical devices like nanobots. We've talked about those before. This was first achieved by Bernard Yenke and colleagues in 2000, who created from DNA strands a pair of tweezers that opened and pinched. Later experiments, such as the Shelley Wickham and colleagues in 2011 at the Oxford Labs, demonstrated nanomolecular walking machines made entirely from DNA that could traverse set routes, and they had little hands and feet as well. Because we covered that in one of our stories, DNA walkers can also carry molecular cargo. So how frightening are these types of things? And these are coming. Oh, God. And there we go. All right, guys. Have an awesome Wednesday. And I will hope to catch up with you on Friday. Everybody, take care.